brains, big brain folks. Flood got them big brain folks. Flood bring them big brain folks. Bring them to the big brain show. Flood put them big brain folks on the fucking big brain show. Flood's big brain show. Flood's fucking big brain show. Big brain show. Flood's fucking big brain show. Yeah.
Wow, we're back and we're live, and we've got Carl Rattle right here on Telegram chat, which is I usually use for a backup, but lately I've been having so much trouble with my primary studio and long delays, which make it very difficult to have conversations. That I'm really glad that Carl uses Telegram. By the way, if you're out there, sadly you still have to use Telegram to be effective. Welcome back to the show, Carl Rattle, and it's great to have you back. Thanks for joining the show and for giving us a couple hours of your time tonight.
That's absolutely no problem, Flip.
Fantastic. I'm going to turn you up here. One of the reasons I do a group chat here is because it gives me a little volume control that the person-to-person calls don't. One of the reasons I use the group chat is because I can mute myself twice and because I can get more volume control. How you been doing? And tell us, what has Carl been up to since the last time you've been on the show? I know that you're a pretty busy guy.
I've been pretty busy. I mean, usually just, you know, I'm doing well in my own way. Had a couple of health issues around a tooth, but that's about it. But then I've been doing a lot of research and around things like, you know, if you remember the 1940 film Jud Sus, and there is a historical character behind that called Jud Sus Oppenheimer. I've been doing a lot of research about him. I've been digging into some of the history around the quote-unquote blood libel Jewish ritual murder and doing write-up of some of the cases. And I've been generally carrying on with what I do and trying to bring some bit of elucidation and light to otherwise difficult areas.
So you've been wrecking faggots on Twitter, is what you're saying?
Yeah, kind of.
A little bit.
It's kind of interesting when you get into this kind of stuff. It seems arcane to a lot of people, but you have to appreciate how much of this stuff is held straight for granted by a lot of people, that all this stuff is complete nonsense until you dig into it and you're like, oh, no, it's probably not.
I'm sure that does happen. You know, somebody asked me to ask you, and it's probably a great lead-in to some of the things that you are actually working on, and you do have your hands in a lot of things, but somebody asked to ask if you could divulge how things are going with the Europa the Last Battle edit. I know that you were fact-checking and doing some consulting for the Europa team on an updated version. Is that going smoothly?
Yeah, it's been going pretty smoothly. There's a fair amount of people working on it. There's a lot of bits and bobs. There's been, should we say, debates around some things, which is fine. I understand that. There's a lot of opinions around things, and I tend to be the much more conservative around facts than a lot of other people tend to be. So that is coming along apace, and that should we should have something ready. Really, we're talking next month, kind of just as at least the first one or two sections.
Well, that's pretty awesome. I mean, it's nice to hear progress is kind of going smoothly, and I know that a lot of people are very excited for an updated version of Europa. It's been such a tool for us in the red pilling, kind of in the red pilling war. Even though it's a very long documentary, very long movie. It's probably one of the best produced compilations of, just footage and facts that we've kind of got to work with. And I think that with you kind of looking it over and working with them, it'll be even that much more effective because it's important that our arguments be correct, right? It's important that when we talk, when we argue with Jews, when we argue with, shit libs and other, idiots out there, that we are correct in our facts, right? We've talked about this before.
Yeah, I think the is that the concept really is that when you are debating someone or when you are promoting a particular cause, you must have a factual basis. Because if you don't have a factual basis, a lot of people will if you start promoting slight stuff which is obviously wrong, counterfactual or whatever, then people just ignore you. People think you're like the average person, you're the average David Icke believer kind of thing. Like you believe in lizards and that kind of crap. So you have to have a basis, and you have to have it so that it kind of feels that it's intuitively right. That's why the Jewish question made such a huge amount of progress with a lot of people. It's because they can intuitively see that we are right because they look on X, they see what happens on X. They look on the news, they can see what's happening on the news. They look on they go to I don't know, they watch a film, look at the credits on the film. Jews all the way down that. And they start to wonder, they put things together, and that's what you want. You want people to be to realize that what you are saying is intuitively correct. They might not like it, but they can tell that you're not lying to them. And that's a huge point. But if you start saying like random stupid crap, like I don't know, Hitler was one of the Illuminati or some other crap like that, people just look at you like going, what the hell are you on about? Kind of thing. You understand me?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to lose somebody, and especially if it sounds absurd. What I found is the more absurd something sounds, the obviously the faster you're going to lose someone's attention, but also the more likely it is to be true. I mean, especially when we're talking about Jews and Jewish crime and things that they've been, doing for a long time. Do you ever? I mean, you've got to hit this wall all the time with people, where they just don't believe that the Jews can be evil and that Hitler can be the good guy, and you must be dealing with just low-level brainwashing all the time. Do you run into this a lot in your professional life and obviously in your teaching career?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I among other things I do, I teach courses on things like Marxism and things like that. So I kind of run into stuff quite a lot, which is kind of like that. What I tend to find though is it's not about judging someone. A lot of people there's a lot there's a lot of people who tend to want to try and judge. They want to have this conversation with someone, and it's kind of unidirectional. They want to say, "This is the truth, believe it." When in fact it's kind of a conversation. You have to meet someone where they are, and sometimes where they are, if someone is, they're completely deluded. They have a really weird idea, but it's often the people who have been indoctrinated so heavily that they're actually the easiest to reach, because they believe in this stuff, and it's quite easy. Once you know some basic stuff, to be like, okay, well, okay, why do you think that? Okay, are you aware of this? For example, the whole Hitler thing. Are you aware of, of where the alliance came from between Hitler and Stalin? Because that's an often thing. It's not normally say, oh, Hitler and Stalin allied, they're the same thing. But do you know where that alliance came from? Do you know why that alliance came about? And then all of a sudden, starts to click, and then people are told things like Stalin believed in socialism in one country, and this therefore means that Stalin, was couldn't possibly have wanted to invade Hitler and invade or be a threat to Hitler. And then you bring out Stalin's speech. I think it's in, was it August 1939? It's one of the most secret speeches. It's often called Stalin's secret speech because it was so incendiary when they found it. And it's one of the bases for Viktor Sourov's iceberg hypothesis. Basically, they've been denying that they've had various Jews like I can't remember his name now. Godlovsky is his surname. I can't remember the rest of it, but he was one of the key people in trying to deny the speech was real, because they realized very quickly that this speech basically said, because what Stalin says in the speech is, I'm going to invade Europe, I'm going to attack people, I'm going to attack Hitler, my goal is to invade Europe, Germany, my goal is to invade France and England, and he's talking in the context of circa 1940s, kind of that time. So all of a sudden, the whole socialism in one country thing completely disappears. That interpretation completely goes out the window. And for a lot of people, this is huge. This is revolutionary. This is a revolutionary concept. But it's about, again, meeting people where they are, giving people some information that they can check, because you can check on, you can actually read it on Wikipedia. It's actually in the text, in the wiki text. So it gives you an. If you do that, you'll find people are a lot more receptive to your message, rather than just giving people a lecture. You want to, as I've kind of said many times before, you want to plant seeds, because sometimes the best will in the world, someone isn't prepared to listen. Then they're not prepared to listen now, but they might be prepared to listen in the future. And they will remember you were the person who told them. You didn't judge them. You just told them, look, this is the truth. Here's a basic source. Go and check it. And at some point in the future, they'll come back to that. When they come back to that, they'll remember that you told them that, and they will have a positive association between you and the truth. And that's what you want. And that's kind of where I try to get to, is I don't sugarcoat things for a lot of people, and I get in various different fights with people because people don't like information. They don't like it when I contradict them, when I say something is wrong, or I argue with them, because it doesn't imp it doesn't you know it, there's no it's not fashionable. It's not easy to say, oh yeah, I really I it's re it's re it'd be really easy for me to sort of just take a simple position and say I agree with this one group because they're the bog people, and that's the people I want to I want to talk to all the time. But no, I'd rather take the truthful position, even if it causes me endless problems, which it does, because I end up having arguments with people from like both sides at the same time.
Well, we see that, and wow, we just heard Carl Rattle laugh, I think, for the first time ever. I knew that was going to happen tonight. I said, we're going to get Carl to laugh, because as a professor, you've got to be serious all the time, and this is a big thing, because personality plays a lot to do with this, and the way people are treated has a huge impact on how receptive they are to the information, particularly uncomfortable information. And as a professor, I'm sure that you've probably even, if not ha been trained, had to train people on, a way to relate to people, right? Because it's not just about bombing them with facts. And when people get on the defensive, they immediately become, immune to absorbing anything, and they get involved in, kind of a fight instead. And that doesn't help us, right? It doesn't really help us to just wreck people all the time. We really do have to, like you said, meet them where they are. And the seed planting analogy, even though you have said it many times, I don't think you can say it enough times. I think that people need to realize that a lot of the things that you plant today will bloom tomorrow. And yeah, those people will remember you. They will remember the things that you said, and then that will start to build trust in that relationship, right?
Yeah, it comes down to you have to be the best representative of what you believe, and if you are the person who gives them information but doesn't try and force them to believe in it, because if you look at how leftists debate, particularly Marxists on X, and how they kind of just how they go kind of they just kind of like basically they basically just spurg all the time at people. They spurg lots of information at someone, and then they don't have a conversation with anyone. They just basically just make a statement. They go, ha ha ha, I win, and then run off. And that isn't very effective. Yeah, it sounds great from a purely rhetorical point of view, but it doesn't help anyone. It doesn't give people any information. It just means that they're just going, oh yeah, look, I've won, I'm brilliant, or whatever. It's a weird debate tactic, to the least. It doesn't really work. I don't really know where it comes from in that regard, because Jews do that, but they don't tend to be so brazenly stupid like that half the time. This tends to be all the people who are like the, I believe Stalin is the best thing since sliced bread kind of people, who just want to give you a lecture about, the Soviet Union was still just a paradise, apart from all the people starving to death. But that just apart from all the starving to death, the shooting to death, the denying that crime could happen, and all this kind of weird stuff that happened in the Soviet Union. I'm sure it was a paradise for someone somewhere, particularly if you were a Jew in Moscow. But there you
Yeah, it was totally fine, right? Except
go.
for, yeah, all the dead.
Yeah, all the dead. Yeah, just all the white people that they like to deny if it happened.
Man, it's I deal with those kind of people all the time too, and you've got the patience of a saint, I think. I see you make the same arguments on Twitter quite often, and but you do it very well. You never really you don't really get mean unless you intend to. Like, that's one thing I like about your style is your shots are very well intended, and they're very obviously intended. And you have to deal with a lot of people that just they live in this solipsistic sort of fantasy where they're just right and they just wreck you all the time, and they're just like, ugh, they're high-fiving each other or themselves, mostly themselves, I assume. They go to very, very far lengths to try to make points or try to score a gotcha, but things aren't really that complicated, are they? In your professional, life, or just, you're a professor, how is Occam's razor has got to be the dominating, sort of solution to the unknown things, right? How often is Occam's razor useful compared to some of these really crazy, fanciful theories that we've all heard? Generally, I mean, it's called Occam's razor, and it's often cited for a good reason, right? It's usually correct. Is that your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I always, I'm sorry, I'm perpetually using Occam's razor, because I hold to a very simple code on this, which is that you have the least possible amount of assumptions, but also make sure that if you are making a case, that you look at the context, particularly around something, because usually one of the classic things that you find is that what seems to be true, it isn't necessarily true unless you've got some of the context of what's going on at that particular moment in time. Because this is why when people say things, it's like, okay, what's the context this is said in? There's not, okay, so Hitler said X. Okay, Goebbels said Y. Okay, but what's going on? Why are they saying it? Because think about it. If you're Hitler, if you're Goebbels, you aren't just saying that just because I'm going to make an ideological statement. No, you're saying it for a reason. You're saying it because something's happened. Something's happened at that particular time that's caused that conversation or that point to come up. So, what is that? Can we work out what that is? Okay, fine. Then we have the context. Then we have to. So then we can say, is it a really ideological statement, or is it because they're just genuinely quite pissed off at that particular time because something has happened, or? Is it because, or in this case of going back to the law of parsimony, aka Occam's razor, are we saying, what is this truly the simplest solution? Is there any context which makes this make sense? And I would kind of talk about this with students quite a lot, is that I'll say that there is, when you're looking at a story, sometimes there is bits of information that's what we call lacunae. So the gaps, and the problem is, why do we have gaps? Why do we have these gaps? These gaps shouldn't exist. These should make sense. And occasionally, when you put a bit of information into an equation that you didn't put in before, it suddenly makes sense of a whole lot of lacunae that otherwise don't make a heck of a lot of sense. But then, when you put that little bit of information or additional bits of information into the mix, it makes it a hell of a lot more makes a hell of a lot more sense all of a sudden, really, really fast. But a great example of that is the 1933 boycott of the German goods, or Havara, or something like that, where you add the context and all of a sudden it makes perfect sense of what's going on. Why do the Germans pursue Havara so much? Why do Germans do a boycott of Jewish products? Well, because the American Zionists have literally had a conference about a couple of days beforehand, which the Germans have created an entity a day before in anticipation of that conference to potentially do a response to it. What happens? Okay, the predictable happens. The American Zionists come out and say, we're going to launch a boycott of German. We've got a boycott of German goods. This then causes Germany a problem because Germany has a lack of, has a real trade deficit problem caused by a lack of foreign currency, which it had since 1931. So it wasn't a new thing, but it was a real big problem. But they were very vulnerable to it. So they came up with a response, which was don't buy Jewish in response, which then, kept some of the money in house, but also it may suddenly make sense of why the Germans would pursue Havara, because it's a very easy way to get large amounts of money really, really quickly, while possibly also helping pursue the other policy of the Jew of realizing the Jewish question. But also, it comes from earlier. It comes from 1932. It doesn't come from 1933. It comes from 1932, and it was originally a was going to just be a normal German policy. So it gives you all that little bits of information. You tweak it, and all of a sudden, it suddenly makes sense of the Germans are not re they're not crazy people. Why are they doing this? What is this logic? What are they trying to achieve? It's the same is true of Wannsee and then the revisionist position. That when you look at Wannsee in the traditional narrative of it's code words for mass genocide, it doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense. But then you go, oh, actually, well, if we take it for what it actually is, what it suggests it is, and we say to the revisionist position of, well, it's the Germans basically having made a bad policy, which is the ghettoization of the Jews, it was a short-sighted policy, then, and they're responding to the consequences of this policy because all of a sudden they've got massive loads of disease, they've got problems out the wazoo with these ghettos. And they have no end in sight of what they have. So they have to find another solution, particularly in and around the disease and the fact that you've got large amounts of diseases being transferred from the ghettos to the Polish population, the German population, et cetera, et cetera. It's a real problem. So what do? They come up with a camp solution, which is an old system. It's a very, very common way of dealing with it, actually. And then all of a sudden we get to this whole, the whole camps and whatever, whatever, whatever. But all of a sudden, again, it makes that sense. It makes a lot of sense as all of a sudden as to what the Germans are doing. They're saying, well, we were in a war. We need labor. Okay, so how do we achieve that? Well, we need to have as much labor as we possibly can. Then, okay, our factories in the West, which is mainly in Germany, a lot of the factories were in the Rhineland, they're in Cologne, they were whatever. So these are being bombed. Okay, so we're going to do what the Soviet Union did. We're going to move all our industry east. So what do? They move it to three sets of camps. You have Stutthof, and you have Majdanek, and you have Auschwitz. And these are massive camp systems. They are run by very, very well-regarded figures within the SS. People don't often know that Rudolf Höss, the commandant of Auschwitz, was a long-term friend of Martin Bormann's. He goes right back to the very, very early period of the NSDAP. So you've got all these different people. You've got all these systems that are being created. All these historical bits of information, which suddenly make a lot of sense all of a sudden. The same is true with when I read Carter Heydrich's Critical Mass and realizing that there was a second German bomb program, and the fact that about the German U-boat 234, which is also ha happens to be our, the name of one of the radioactive uranium elements. But U-234 was actually captured by the US in 1945, carrying loads of uranium and other things. And all of a sudden, the bomb project in the US suddenly has all these solutions. It suddenly has loads of it solved a bunch of problems all at once. It's solved its problem with the fuses for the bombs. It's solved, it's got bomb material. It's that kind of weird thing. It just suddenly makes a lot of sense as to what was going on, because there's been it's all these weird things that people didn't realize, that the Japanese had an atomic bomb, had an atomic bomb project. And one of the things, have you ever heard of the film? It's a very famous British film. It's called The Bridge Over the River Kwai.
Oh, certainly. Yes.
Do you know what the purpose of the Bridge Over the River Kwai was? In reality.
I don't. I actually don't even recall the film, but I know the name. I've heard it several times, many times over my
So
life.
basically, it's where they the Japanese are using British and British. It's in the film, it's largely British, but in reality, it was British and large amounts of Burmese and Thai labor to build this long this railway and bridge, and a big particular bridge in the jungle to. For a railway line. And they never really explained why. It's kind of left kind of vague as, oh yeah, it's just for supplying the front. But that's not actually the reason. The reason is because that particular area, it's going to and from a major source of rare earths for nuclear research. And this was linked very heavily to the Japanese atom bomb project. So again, when we go back to history, all of a sudden it makes sense of why would the Japanese be doing this? Why would they do this, have this such a focus on this bridge? Well, the reason is because that it's part of their bomb project. And they're fully cognizant of they're in the atomic bomb race and they are well behind. So what happens? The Japanese copy the Germans. They have the idea of, okay, we're gonna build a bomb, but the Japanese don't get very far with it. But nevertheless, that is the purpose behind that particular part of history. So it's not just the Japanese are being crazy. All of a sudden, they're being quite rational. It's just that you didn't have a bit of information that all of a sudden you put that information into the mix, and law of parsimony triggers, and all of a sudden it makes perfect sense.
This is incredible. I mean, this is a very detailed explanation of context and lacunae. I've learned a new word today, lacunae. And thank you for that. A missing part or a missing piece or a gap in information, right? And that's really what we're up against is we have these wild assertions of the Germans, of Hitler, and that they just were all insane. And they all just hated Jews overnight. And of course, there's obviously massive amounts of missing context, including, large and small details that really, really do bring the value to any factor or, anything in the subject matter, right? So a lot of these points could just be meaningless, really, until everything that happens around those things. This happened with the Holocaust, obviously. The directive that doesn't exist, that nobody can seem to find, where it says get rid of the Jews, why there were camps, why they had Zyklon B at the camps, all of these things very easily explained with a few small details. But it's very easy for the other side to just omit all of that, jump into these essentially smears and slanders and attacks, and that's what they've built an industry on. That's what they've, I mean, the Holocaust industry is massive and only growing, right? Only getting bigger and bigger. Huntress said thank you very much for revising revisionism, and I think that's a very good point. You're revising a revisionist documentary, and you've got a lot of fans in this chat right now. A lot of people really, really love Carl Rattle and all the stuff that you're working on for us. I'd like to ask a question about something, but I don't know if it's sensitive or not, and so I don't want you to answer anything that you don't want to. But we had
Carry
Otto.
on. I did.
Go ahead.
Carry on.
Okay, I had Otto
Carry on.
on the show since you were last on, and he taught us all about the Volga Germans and his book, The Myth of the Great Silence. And he had mentioned that obviously as an academic in America, studying the history that he studies and professes on, that it's very difficult for him to get work. And so that sort of led into a conversation about buying his book. By the way, guys, he's got a great book out there called The Years of Great Silence, and it gives a lot of context behind what was happening to Germans, you know, in the Volga, along the Volga, and in the, you know, in the Volga area before the war, and even in some cases before the Reich even came to power. There were millions of Germans that were being systematically slaughtered. It wasn't just Danzig. It wasn't just, you know, all of the other territories that Hitler wanted to reunify with, but this was an epidemic in the region between World War I and World War II for a very long time. I went into a whole thing there for no reason, because essentially he was talking about, though, it's very difficult for him to find work as a professor because obviously, you know, there are blacklists in academia, and he had also mentioned that it was very difficult for the book to move because it wasn't a very popular subject. Of course, a lot of people are ignorant of that region, and of course that's why it was called Years of Great Silence. But he's also working on a project, I believe for you, that could actually be, I think, one of the most popular projects that ever happened kind of in our circles. And of course, I'm talking about the protocols, but I don't want to get too far into what he is or isn't doing for you. Is there any taboo around that kind of work? Could that get you in, or him in, you know, in trouble at work, so to speak?
Yeah. I mean, there is a significant taboo around some stuff in academia. In particular, the idea of, shall we say, making people have access to information and documents and arguments which certain establishment parts within academia do not want people to have, because all of a sudden it makes the academia's job very hard. Because you have to remember that it's kind of what I talked about a little bit in the last week or so, quite a bit, is that a lot of people in academia are really time servers. There's a lot of people who are time servers, and what's happened over the years is you've got a situation where you've got the hard bit of history. So the hard bit of history, I would say, would be like the archival stuff. And you've got the soft bit of history, which is the interpretive stuff. And as there's been a real shift away in the last 20, 30 years away from the hard stuff into the easy stuff. And that's been also been in line with where people have focused their energy. There's an awful lot of written about feminist history. And I can't tell you how ridiculously bad a lot of feminist history is. I mean, I'm currently reading a book by a lady called Catherine Hall, who is a mud shark, to the least. She's very proud of it. she wrote a book. She wrote the book about slavery. And one of these things that I was reading it. And it's not a bad book in that it's quite interesting. It kind of it brings out a lot of different things when you actually read it and you just ignore the language. But basically, a lot of what she had written, you could minus about, I would say, about 30-40% of it, and you would get a better book. And it comes back to that kind of thing of, there's a lot of people that focus on the interpretive element because that is the element that's easy. You can produce a paper really quickly. It's not hard to get published, and all of a sudden you're fine. Whereas if you're doing the hard stuff like Otto does a lot of hard slog, you know, work in archives and about, you know, what was Soviet policy towards the, you know, ethnic group, what was going on, you know, what was the correspondence between these different things. That's a huge slog of work. It takes a lot to do that. It gets easier as you get on because you have lots of context that you can just pull in, but it's an incredibly hard thing to do. And it was David Horowitz, weirdly enough, the kind of Jewish, one of the Jewish intellectuals behind a lot of what I would call the modern Israel lobby, who kind of actually said the same thing. But he said it about 10 years ago. He said the same thing, basically saying that he noticed that a lot of people had moved away from diplomatic history, which is his field, part of his field, and that there's very few people writing in that, because diplomatic history is very, very intensely archival. There's not a lot you can do with like words on that one. You need to actually read the treaties, learn what was going on between people, and read the context. Whereas if you do, whereas with say feminist history doesn't, you don't need to do much research at all. I mean, really, you just have to kind of read a couple of secondary source books, and then offer a quote unquote reinterpretation of something. And I remember reading a journal article by in the journal Socialist History, and it was so unreadable because it was just basically, I think it was called Unwriting Men's Lived Experiences or something. But it was just a complete gobbledygook for about 30
You,
pages.
yeah.
And I wasn't the only one who thought so, because someone wrote in to the next and the next the next the next the next volume and said, on this article, I don't understand what the hell this person is writing about. Basically, in polite academic terms. But that's kind of the point, is that there's a lot of stuff in academia is very diff is very it's very much fashion based. I mean, a lot of people say, a lot of people say will say, oh, go and read, I know the book a book by like Richard Overy or someone. But the reality is Richard Overy is like a pretty crap academic historian, really. He's not that good. He's not an archival historian, certainly. And I was kind of talking about this in the other days online, just because I think it's really important for people to realize that the reality is a lot of historical research is actually done by amateurs. Particularly in regards to, there's a whole bunch of fields like military history, crime, the history of crime, biography, that kind of world, where basically the amateurs rule very much so. And it's just and it's really and then what's and then what's left is done by a relative few archival historians, and the rest is just archival historians, like normal historians, sort of trying to graft off of that. And that comes back to the thing with Otto, is that writing about hard stuff is never popular. It's unfortunately it's a really hard thing to do, to write an academically very good book while writing a book that's really interesting to read. It's they're two very almost they're not mutually exclusive, but they're very hard to do together. And people like Irving are one of a very few amount of people who can do that well. And I've only encountered maybe three or four people who actually write better than Irving does. When they do, they can do it really, really well. It's just it's very, very rare. And
That
that
makes
kind of comes back
sense.
to
Well, I
yeah,
mean, you end
and
up to a
I
lot of
mean.
garbage, right? There's a lot of trash history out there being written by people that are following trends of the time, is what it sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah, they are following from the time, but they're not. It's just they just what they do is they there's a lot of what I would call reference and quotation recycling. And Irving has pointed this out as well. And that's not just me, and others have said the same thing. That a lot of these people, they you, the way he put it was, they will say, "Oh, that's a great quotation. I'll put it in my book." And they don't check the quotation. They just go and they stuck it in their book. And this is what Carlo Mottone found when he did his article on the Gypsy Holocaust, quote unquote, which is again another bit of the Holocaust people didn't know about, is that allegedly the Germans also gassed another 200,000 to 300,000 gypsies at Auschwitz. And he did a lot of work on that, and he worked out actually the main two sources on it are basically quoting each other. They're not quoting original documents. They're quoting each other as authorities, which is ironic. And then when you actually go and dig into it, you work out the truth is the opposite of what they're claiming. So it's that kind of thing where you want to write something that is interesting to read, but at the same time you want something that's factual. And getting that kind of balance is really, really hard. And in academia, that is how you make your money. You make your money basically in academia by so say you're a student. I will say, okay, I'm going to make my book required reading on my course. You have to pay me $50 for this book. I make a profit from that. If you don't have that kind of source of income, you have to go other ways. And other ways is like you do like appearances and documentaries, which is why you get all those academics and documentaries. That's why they do it, because that's a good way to get money and interest in your work and all that kind of thing. Or you try and write for the pop history market. And there's a bunch of people who just do that, and some of them do it very well. Most people do it very badly, and then you end up in a situation where people believe all sorts of rubbish. And because basically they had someone sell them a particular concept, which doesn't have any bearing to what academic history says. It's like when people say, you get some people, you get somebody who says something ridiculous. Like I'll give you an example of like a Marxism example. They'll say that, oh yeah, Marx was a Satanist. Though the occasion every I'd say every 10 years, a Catholic priest or author will come out with a book which says Karl Marx was a Satanist, based upon one poem that Karl Marx wrote while he was at the University of Bonn. What they don't tell you, usually in that case, is they don't tell you that that's referencing a letter that Karl Marx also wrote around that same time to his father, basically saying basically he's having a sexual relationship with an old man. And that's what Karl Marx is actually talking about. He's not talking about he's worshiping the devil. He's talking about the fact that he's engaging in sodomy.
Wow, what, that's mind-blowing. But the incredible amount, and again, the context changes the meaning of everything in the original assertion. I see what you mean about, how like amateur historians, we've got one in our chat now, Vale of Shadows. He's a prolific historian, military historian, works on Gab, spends time writing up, very thoughtful write-ups of history, battles, things that that we've often forgotten or we weren't taught about, and he takes it very seriously. But he's also, he's an amateur historian, so he does digging around and sources what he can, I'm sure. But doesn't have to publish, doesn't have to get reviewed, doesn't have any of the bottlenecks or the roadblocks that you would have to bring something, research to the public. I didn't know that about, that essentially you had to set classes up and things to sell your own material, or to at least, make that part of the curriculum, just in order to even make ends meet or to make money. That sounds terrible. Like, shouldn't professors get paid well for what they do? I mean, shouldn't you get a nice check just to show up, or you really have to kind of wrangle business deals behind the, kind of behind the curriculum to just to get a little bit of money, huh? I guess that's normal, huh? Is this Judaized institutionalism? It seems we should like
No, it's
regard and
actually been
pay you guys a lot or something.
it's been around for it's been around since the dot, really. You have to remember that people like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, they were both pretty poor for quite a lot of their lives, because they basically they wrote books and they wrote popular stuff to make money, to fund their research, to fund what they actually wanted to do, which was, in Tolkien's case, was to discuss, the various different, sagas, the Northern world, and the age of the Vikings and Beowulf and all that stuff. So essentially, that's always been the way. It's just, for a lot of people now, it's become very, very political to do that, and you have to do much, yes, be much more, I would say, open about it. Because historically, you just write something and then someone would pick up what you said, and they would run with it, and you'd have a they call it the age of the pamphlets. As people used to write a pamphlet against someone else, and then next week there'd be another pamphlet flying back the other way, and that kind of thing. That would be more the case of they're doing it for to make a point, to argue, and then their real source of income in that case is really patronage. People, some guy, some king or duke or some banker or something, paying for their chair, which is where the concept comes from. You paid for my chair. I've got a seat at the university. This chair is paid by me, and I decide to some degree what that academic does, which is why you have this network of these, talk about a term, like Jewish bone chairs, who then promote a very particular narrative, because that's what they're fundamentally paid for. The stipend pays their salary, pays for everything else, but in return they have to promote this particular concept, and it's just how it is. And it works it work it can work for you and against you. It works for you when you're in power. It works very much against you when you're not. But the positive of that system is that it it control it, there is some kind of control about what academics are doing, because historically academics could go off and do some all sorts of weird stuff. They would just run off and just do whatever they have and have an argument with someone else, which is actually where the whole concept of Marxism kind of comes from. It comes from an academic argument between David Strauss and Leo and Feuerbach and all that kind of crowd, but with their universities over, are they allowed to say certain things? In this case, it was really about, are they allowed to say certain things about Christianity stroke Jesus? That's where the entire of Marxism really comes from. It's that debate, but that debate then triggers all the young Hegelians on the left, young Hegelians on the left, to kind of go off on their own and do their own thing, and get basically banned, and then they create the French German yearbook, which then becomes its own thing for a couple of, for about a year, 2, 3 years, and they also write some journal articles for their little newspaper, and then all of a sudden they'll break up and they'll go in their own little world, and you have Karl Marx and Engels go one way, you have Max Stirner with go the way of anarchism, you have Bakunin go the way of anarchism, but those two are different. Then you've got people like Feuerbach, who just goes into a basically he Ludwig Feuerbach just goes into a cottage and just writes. Bruno Bauer, same thing. He goes and writes an antipathy book. And then you've got other people who decide to do something completely different and go and do their own thing. Get other people who fade away, like Arnold Ruge. Then you've got Moses Hess, who's Zionism plus communism. And this is the point. It's like where you suddenly you realize all these people come from this particular thing that happened, in the same way that National Socialism and Hitler really come from what happened in the First World War, and then the Bolshevik Revolution, and then the various revolutions between 1917, 1919, 1920, throughout Europe. So that's and then it would spread like wildfire, the same way that so you have Hitler and the NSDAP, but then you've got the Iron you've got the what do you call them? The Iron Guard in Romania, you've got the Hungarian nationalists that become the Arrow Cross, you've got Horthy in Hungary as well, who comes to power because of Béla Kun and his Soviet Republic that occurs there, which was extremely Jewish, to the point of lunacy. And then you've got the similar things that happen in France, similar things that happen in Britain. I mean, in Britain at the time, in the Britain that you have in the 20s and 30s, the reason why Britain almost joins Germany in being as an ally, if it wasn't for itself, was because the British Communist Party had tried to break Britain in the 20s. It's called the great. It was the it's called the General Strike. I think it was in 26. Come think of it, or 26, 28, I think. And then it's the same concept of you add that in, all of a sudden, this is why British aristocracy were pro Germany in general. Why you had so many people who were pro Germany that it scared MI5 to death. Again, there is these things that come into the equation. The same is true of why did someone was claiming that the Germans talked about something called the Jewish problem. Well, they didn't really talk about the Jewish problem. That's an English way of phrasing it, in that they're talking about, well, okay, this comes from the concept of the alien problem. The alien problem is something that has something that is, comes to be talked about, is really referring to the 1880s Ashkenazi immigration from the Pale settlement in the Russian Empire to the West in from the 1880s to the 19 to 1917, really 1914, 1917. And you get these laws, one of which is the Aliens Act of 1905, which is the British anti-Jewish laws. It's deliberately designed to make Jewish settlement in Britain next to impossible, because basically the Ashkenazim were causing problems, in particularly around the East End. Most famously, we know of Jack the Ripper, but there's a bunch of other people who, cases we know were Jewish. For famous in the context of Jack the Ripper, you have the case of Israel Lipsky, who goes and murders someone. You've also got all these people who start coming out of the East End. You've got lots of communists, lots of Jewish gangsters. If you look at the series Peaky Blinders, what they leave out there is that the Sabini gang, who ran the racecourses in Britain, were actually Jew were actually were largely a Jewish gang. They weren't. They had some Italian in them, but they were largely Jewish, which is completely left out of that series for obvious reasons, because that would kind of scare people. And you have the same thing going on in the US. You've got the Purple Gang in Chicago and all these kind of gangs that are going on. Then you have famously Al Capone, but again, we don't talk about the fact that Al Capone was basically a patsy for a bunch of Jewish people, for a bunch of Jewish gangsters. He was basically the front man for a whole series of Jewish concerns. And he became the person everyone focused on rather than all the Jews. So again, it's that little bit of context of this leads to this leads to that. That situation then causes this to happen. The same is true with why are the Russians, not Russian nationalists in the 20s, why are they so anti-Jewish? Because there are so many Jews in the Bolshevik movement. Well, would you know that? Why? But then, okay, let's go look at the death of the Tsar. Who kills the Tsar? Entire command structure was Jewish. And it's the same thing. It's like when you go and you add context, you can see that people aren't being irrational. People are being quite reasonable if you add in certain context, which comes back to the law of parsimony, which comes back into and people understanding situations, because you add in that little bit of information and then you reinterpret it for them. And you say, well, if you add this in, all this now makes sense. And all of a sudden, you can see people's kind of mind go, oh, that not only does that make sense, that completely changes my understanding of what is happening here, what is talked about, and I can see why something is wrong. I can see why the mainstream interpretation of this is wrong, because it completely leaves all this out. It's a complete travesty of basically they're trying to shoehorn an interpretation in to make a point, not to make a point, make an interpretation from the evidence. They're not deductive. They're not reasonably. They're not deriving their thoughts from the evidence. They're trying to make a predetermined conclusion fit the evidence. If you want to put
This
it
is
that way.
incredible. Like this is so you were just explaining exactly how things come about and minds get blown exactly while I was thinking how my mind is fucking blown by this. Like it's this is to me is very revelatory because it so many things I made assumptions about that I didn't actually know, but it does go it works forwards and backwards. Whether you're looking backwards, the context has to be there. But even back then, this was just a series of, it seems almost like academia, these movements, all of these things were kind of born from just a series of reactions or a series of reactionary movements to whatever had just happened, in history. And so it does kind of, it seems to lead to an academic, or I would say an academic landscape that's largely left-leaning. Of professors that don't make very much money. I was actually kind of shocked at this. Like to me it's terrible that I mean you have some of the hardest earned credentials, but you're some of the least well compensated for that work. And that's that of course makes sense in retrospect, but at the same time it's not I wasn't walking around the world thinking that was the way things were for most of my life until right now. And I'm just like my mind's blown. I always thought that like with the respect, with the hard work, came success, came at least a decent enough paycheck to continue to do your job. But it sounds like that's just not the case unless you're part of a certain group, who gets preferable treatment when it comes to funding, when it comes to money and people who will fund or grant money for research. Just it seems very dirty now, and I can kind of see, man, if you take it all the way back to Marx and kind of how things came this way, how things became this way, it paints a much bleaker picture, honestly, than what I had thought before, which was just Jews came in and bought everything, bought everybody, and established a narrative. Because if you could imagine a whole bunch of essentially nihilistic academics running all over the place, just looking into whatever they want. Of course, the result would be chaos. The result would be confusion. People would be contradicting each other and fighting constantly. and there would never be, you know, an official narrative, nor would there be the ability to put one in place, right? Like, we couldn't agree on history or anything else if that were the case, right? So does there kind of have to be this overarching narrative and a rigid structure of people who either conform to it or who go against it?
Yeah, I probably say there has to be in some regards, because you get these people. You get the thing about academics, people don't realize, academics and intellectuals in general, is that they don't do well if you just allow them to do whatever they want, because essentially a lot of academia is really about being an intellectual prostitute for whatever it is. You know, if you're not willing to be that, then you will not succeed, which is why you get people like Deborah Liebstadt getting chairs, even though she's barely done any original work in her life, but because she fits the narrative and she's Jewish and she basically ticks these boxes, she gets the plum stuff. Whereas someone like Otto, who should be getting that kind of chair, doesn't, because he doesn't fit what particular narrative they want to promote. So basically, this is kind of how our academia has always been to some degree, but if you give academics a kind of like a framework, they do much better, because there's always a temptation among academics that they're going to basically go off and just do what they like, and they'll come up with some subversive shit. They'll publish some subversive shit.
Yeah.
You're better giving them a rubric and saying, focus on this, do this, and then have a little bit of oversight about what's going on with them, because you will get problems with them at some point. It's just, it's a matter of when and how you deal with that. So the Reich was very good at this, actually. It basically required all academics to make a declaration of loyalty to Adolf Hitler. Said, you have to declare this publicly. And a lot of academics did. Even if they weren't necessarily fans of the NSDAP, they said, well, okay, whoever pays the piper calls the tune, therefore I will adhere to it. But then it flashed out all the other people who really had a problem with the Third Reich, had a real problem with Hitler, who refused to do anything, so they could then get rid of them, and they could promote all the people who wanted to adhere to the new order. They were pro the new order. They put them in instead. So then you got a flourishing of work in the same way that in the medical field, the same thing happened. You got rid of a lot of the dead wood and the people who, you know, the orthodoxy says kind of people, and you put in new people. And what happens is, because you basically did a complete, you burnt away a lot of the dead wood, you inevitably produce some really, really good work. And some of the things in academia, some of the information we have in academia largely comes from the Third Reich period. A great example is people didn't realize that Himmler thought he came from a family of a convicted witch who was burnt at the stake in Germany. And Himmler was the person who said, ah, okay, I've got a problem. I'm trying to work out about witches in Germany. Okay, so how do I do this? How do I do this? Because there's basically in Germany, it's the Holy Roman Empire, the First Reich, and you've got all these disparate records. So I need to bring them all together. So Himmler creates something called Project H or Project Hexen, as in German for witch, and then says, basically, I'm going to get researchers bring all these records together in one place so I can see all the information about witches in Germany during the medieval and the early modern period. And then this project Hexen becomes the basis for a lot of modern research on witches, because it's the best series of information that exists about witches in continental Europe, which is why if you read anything about witchcraft, the witch trials, you'll often find references to what was going on in Germany, because it's the best documented because Himmler brought together all this stuff together in one place, which is again what they don't tell you. Conversely, you have people say, well, okay, you have the famous exhibition to Tibet. Well, okay, what are the Germans doing there? Because the Germans aren't crazy. There's a whole industry that's basically devoted to try and make the Germans sound absolutely nuts and to come up with some weird ideas and stuff like that. Okay, so the Germans send an expedition to Tibet. Why are they doing that? Well, they're sending a lot of odd people for an expedition. They're sending geneticists, sending a botanist, they're sending a geographer, they're sending an anthropologist. So it's odd. It's an odd combination of people, and they're all being led by a guy who basically is an adventurer stroke likes to hunt big game.
Like
Herman Schaefer.
an Indiana Jones type of a character.
Yeah, he was the original Indiana Jones. In many respects, the concept of Indiana Jones comes from Herman Schaefer, among others.
Amazing.
But why are the Germans do but why but the question is, why are the Germans doing that? I mean, Flood, have you, do you, I mean, I'm sure you've heard of the Tibet expedition. What do you think? Why do you think the Germans would have gone to Tibet?
Well, I, it's actually interesting. I've had this conversation in my chat room for quite a long time this morning, and I was headed here eventually with you, and that was that we often hear the argument about Hitler and the Reich and if they were Christian or if they were pro-Christian or if they were pro-pagan. But this is much more complicated than that. There is a I posit quite wildly and with no evidence that there is a mystical tradition that the Aryans would have had or that they would have brought through time that has been somehow occulted. It has been either destroyed or it has been perverted. And from that may come a lot of the traditions that we assume are associated to Judaism. But actually, I would think that had the Reich come to power, one of the first things I would have done was begin to research my roots, my history. And this is going to go through all of the mystic traditions. Including, hell, anybody that got a copy of the Aurelinda book in the last 100 years would have gone to Kashmir to, start asking questions. Like, our history goes all around the world. I would expect the Reich to have put significant resources into researching these things to find out what we're missing or where did the missing pieces go and how did they end up missing, right? Just like the capstones on the pyramids, right? Everybody assumes there were capstones. Where did they go? And or at least address the idea that there should be capstones there, right? Like it would just make sense, right? We're curious people, and when honest curious people come to power, they're going to want to find out what the hell's going on and what the hell happened, right? I mean, it's probably a very vague and general way of putting it, but that's my thought anyway.
Yeah, so it's not that far off, to be honest. So basically, you have so the Germans created an organization which is very famous, which becomes the base, which sponsors the Tibet expedition, which is the Annenerbe. The Annenerbe is was originally created by, I can't remember his name now. It's going to annoy me now. The original head of the Annenerbe, I can't remember his name.
I'm gonna Google it. I'm gonna Google it right now. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's the, there was two. There was the second was Walter Wurst, but the first one, I can't remember his name, but he has all sorts of links into all this because he was the guy who I'm going to do it myself. It's going to annoy me.
Well, they credit Himmler
So,
secondarily, I suppose.
yeah, it's no, it's stop. It's I yeah, I know who it is, but it's not Dare. It's where is he? It's he's Dutch. I know that. else what's going on right now? Wurst, Wurst. Because so it becomes Wurst. I can't recall his name now. Sorry, I'm gonna. It's gonna. It probably sounds awful. Oh, I can't remember his name. This is one of these ones where it really gets to annoy you for no apparent reason. His name. That's just really. Oh, hey, that's him, Herman Wirth.
Excellent.
Herman Wirth is the key figure in this because he, it comes back to what you said, the Aurelinda book. Herman Wirth is the key figure in the Aurelinda book,
Wow.
and Herman Wirth's background is the study of folk mythology. And basically, he writes a book in 1928 called basically the the origin of man, basically his research on the religion symbols and writings of the Atlantis Nordish race. But the point is, he's getting at, and that there's a bunch of people that's doing it at the same time, is that they are trying to do what we now call Indo-European studies. So they're having the Indo-European homeland debate. Now that is, we have it. We have we know that we know all a lot of languages of Europe are Indo-European. They come from one source. They come from a source people. We call them Indo-Europeans. We call them Proto-Indo-Europeans. The Germans at the time, and basically the 1860s onwards, used the term Aryan a lot for them, from the Iranian, from the Persian area. So what they refer, so basically the Germans are saying, well, okay, we need to find out who these people are. Okay, so what is the connection between them and race? Well, if we have a race, if we have a racial group, which is the Indo-Europeans, and this is the basis of the language, then we need to know where they came from, but also we need to know who are the supreme example of that. And the reason they focus so much on the what we call the Nordic race is because the of the time, and it's until very, very recently, it's been still had some very, very good partisans. It's called the Arctic hypothesis of the Indo-European homeland, which is Scandinavia stroke Germany. And the if you want a car if you want someone who argued this really, really well and as an academic and is very well respected, it would have been the late Jean Haudry, the French nationalist academic, who wrote a book called The Indo-Europeans in 1984. This is well, it's a short book, but it's worth reading for an to argue for an Arctic home for an Arctic home for the Europeans. So essentially what they're doing is they're linking race, they're linking this idea of this the purest original Aryans, as they would call them, Indo-Europeans, because the Indo-European homeland are from Northern Europe, particularly the Nordics, and they're trying to settle this debate, which is why they start doing all these expeditions. They're trying to solve or at least get an idea of what's going on with this. So one of the theories that people don't know about is that one of the proposed Indo-European homelands of the time was Tibet. And they thought, if we go to Tibet, we're going to find traces of the Indo-Europeans, which is why you have a botanist, why you have a geneticist, anthropologist, why you've got a geologist. You've got all these people there who have very particular types of expertise, and why the geneticist, for example, takes lots of samples of their faces. He starts taking lots of casts and whatever, because this is how they do genetic research before DNA. Again, the Germans go there, the Germans get lots of information, and the Germans come back and they say, oh, we think we found lots of traces of this Indo-European culture within Tibetan culture, but it's bastardized with time. And we think we can see that in the Tibetans themselves, because you have to remember that genetics pre-anthropology, so pre-DNA, is very, very different. It's basically they take measurements. They basically what they're doing is they're reducing your features, because the assumption is that phenotype equals genotype. So the expression of how you look and everything you have indicates your genotype. So it indicates that's actually there's a one-to-one relationship in that assumption. Now we know that's not entirely true, but then that was the best science. That was what had how it worked.
Yeah, that was cutting
So
edge
they
at the
are for
time.
the
That's right.
yeah. Just because we now consider that to be incorrect, because we know additional information doesn't take away from that they're doing good science. It's just they're doing good science with some erroneous assumptions, which comes into an awful lot of German how we understand German policy. It's because we're missing this kind of element of what are the Germans doing? Why are they doing it? Because they're not ridiculous. They're not just insane. They're trying to do something. What are they trying to do? Why are they trying to do it? And that comes back to the Tibetan expedition of they are trying to prove it. They're trying to prove it an academic thesis, basically. And Himmler is very, very keen to do that, because Himmler, throughout the throughout the 30s and the 40s, he takes more and more control over Germany's intellectual world, and he has an entire office of the SS under Alfred Six, who also writes under various different names. They have this ideological department, so they start writing things. And then we have people like, Wust, who is an SS officer. He's an Indologist, so he studies Indian. He studies India. He's an expert in Buddhism, and he introduces Himmler to, various Buddhist sutras and whatever. Ironically, Magda Goebbels was a big fan of Buddhism, had been since the 1920s. Was massively well read about it for some for because she would order these great big sets of books on Buddhism. Again, it gets back into this point of what are the Germans doing? They are researching. They're trying to do things. So Himmler's going off and researching witches. He's pulling together lots of things about witches, about German history. He's got large amounts of S of Annenberg researchers going off and, getting large amount getting but what they would call doing folklore research. They're pulling together lots of German folklore, and they're trying to look for traces of the of Aryanness within it. They're looking for this information, but also it comes into what are the Germans doing when we come into much more controversial policies, like what are the Germans doing with Ostforschung? What are they doing with Eastern research? Why are they looking at the East? Why are they kidnapping Polish children? Well, why? Because they are looking for, because their assumption is there's a one-to-one relationship between genetics and between genotype and phenotype. If they see a Polish child who has blonde hair, blue eyes, looks Nordic in their genetic rubric they use, they know in their scientific reasoning that this person has has a lot of Aryan blood. It doesn't matter if they've got a Polish name or a German name. They are fundamentally Aryan. Now, their parents almost certainly had lots of German blood then. But okay, but we can't depolonize the parents. That's very, very hard. So instead, they take the they actually take they will take the child rather than try and rehabilitate the whole family. They take the line of least resistance, as people often do with practical policy, and they say, okay. We'll take the child. We're not going to hurt the child, but we're going to make sure that the child is brought up to be what the child is. The same is true when they go to the Eastern Europe. They begin sifting large amounts of this policy of the East. They begin because they have to remember the Germans then as now. A lot of people then as now believed that the East was a very mixed race area. There's a lot of people who are, very mixed. They view Slavs as like a mixed
Yes,
race group.
Mongoloids, yes.
So they would say, well, okay, I've got a population which is mixed. How do I unmix it? How do I sift it? So they're sifting it by taking they're taking people out who are, as they would call Aryan. They're all Aryan, they have Aryan characteristics. But then they're saying, okay, well, so separate them from the people who don't appear to have that. Therefore, we will get the people who have Aryan characteristics. They are suitable for what the Germans call Germanization. They will be given full rights. It doesn't matter they've got a Russian last name, they've lived in Smolensk for 200 years. It doesn't matter. They are Aryan. And they should and, sh and they should be treated as such. Whereas someone who is, I don't know, say someone's lived in, I don't know, so li lived in Danzig, whatever, and wasn't was didn't have that, and wanted to be, and Jem said, okay, you're not Aryan, you are, you're Polish, you're whatever. So they put them into the general government, which was supposed to be the new Polish little state that was going to be created as a kind of Polish homeland, in the same way that you would have a series of Baltic homelands, you'd have a series of you'd have a Russian homeland, a Ukrainian state. So essentially, the Germans were pulling and they were sieving all this information, all this racial and biological material, and that then gets used against them to create this kind of narrative of, a general plan Ost and the hunger plan and all this kind of nonsense that gets put around without any context whatsoever as being oh, this is the Germans being awful. Well, the Germans aren't being awful. The Germans are being quite clever, actually. But they're doing something that is in the context of the time and quite rational if you look at what they're trying to do and why they're trying to do it and the assumptions behind it. Now, that doesn't mean assumptions are always right. Some of them are wrong. But this is the best science of the time. This is why the Germans do what they do. Again, this comes in what I was saying about why do the Germans do this? Because the traditional narrative is, oh, the Germans just randomly hated everyone. Well, no, they didn't. The Germans aren't doing that. The Germans are trying to be quite rational about this, and they're trying to build a new order in the East. And if you think about it, if you think about the concept of, Lebensraum, okay, the traditional narrative is, oh, they're just going to import loads of Germans from Germany. Well, they didn't have enough Germans from Germany. They barely have enough as it is for Poland, for most of Poland. So what the hell are they going to do with the rest of Russia or part of Russia or whatever they got from the Eastern campaign? So, but where are they getting these people from? Well, they're getting them from A. There's large amounts of Volksdeutsche who are living in the East, which is what Otto studies. And the number of these is like in the order of 12 million. So that gives you an idea of how many of these people there were. But also it gives you an idea for if the Germans are doing that, plus they're sieving the populations for people who are suitably racial, racially suitable. Therefore, what they're doing is they're engaging in a very practical policy of basically building a completely new order in the East by t not by wiping out people, but by sieving people. And that it comes into what are the Germans doing? Okay, well this is the policy again, and you can say, well, what other evidence do we have that they were doing this? And it comes back to what Niccolò Mattioni found out with the Romani, with the Gypsies, is that traditional narratives the Germans hated Gypsies, the Germans want to exterminate Gypsies. This never sat well with me because we have I very very early on come across Annenerbe footage of the studying Romani. So the Annenerbe, the SS were race office, were studying the Romani. Why would they be studying the Romani if they want to kill them? That doesn't make any sense. Because the Annenerbe is this it's the wrong organization. If they were enemies of the state, it would be the Gestapo or the SD or the German Intelligence Combat Office in the six who would be looking at it. But they're not. It's the Annenerbe. Why? Because the Annenerbe as real because what the Germans are doing is that Germans are sieving the Romani. They are essentially the people who go, the Romani who go to Auschwitz are the mixed race Romani. These are the people who are mixed Romani, mixed something else. So they're Romani plus something else. Anyone who was a normal, who was just a full blood Romani, didn't go to Auschwitz. And why did the Germans put them in Auschwitz? Because the Germans were saying, well, we don't want to infect the Romani or the rest of the pure blood Romani or the pure blood Germans with this population, thus we're going to isolate it, and then once the war is over, we are going to just go put it somewhere. We're going to have a final solution to the Romani question or the Gypsy question. This is how the Germans and the NSDAP thought. Again, it's done my point of putting in all these lacunae of why do the Germans do this? And all of a sudden, it makes perfect sense what they're doing, why they're doing it, why they did it the way they're doing it. That's simple.
Mind is blown yet again. But you're right. We come back to filling in the lacunae, and this is something that they dedicated an incredible amount of time and resources to. Obviously, easily twisted into the evil, insane quest for the Ubermensch, and really, it's completely reasonable and logical exactly what they were doing in the time that they were doing it, based on what they believed and the tools that they had at hand. So you're absolutely right. And what I find funny are the parallels to today. It's I keep hearing in my head the gatekeeping that we hear in the Twitter spaces of, hey man, am I white enough? Do I my parents were my grandmother was Spanish and I'm my grandfather was Scottish. There's a lot of race qualifying that goes on in the current movement, and I know that it's a completely different situation, completely different context. But it's the exact same thing that's happening, is that there's a lot of sifting going on in the neo-Nazi movement, right? And it's kind of funny because it's problematic and it's destructive in the way that it's done now, but the way that it was originally done had a completely different intention, completely different set of goals, and was the polar opposite of what they're doing today with this same tactic, right? It's just to me, I it feels like a parallel, but it's not. It's more of a perpendicular, you know, line. So obviously they wanted to fill in the gaps in what they understood of history and of the Aryan race. At what point did the Viril Society come into this, and at what point did, you know, like Orsic and all of this talk about like off-worlders and you know the blonde, you know, the what they call them, the blondes, I suppose, or something. There's a lot of talk around this as well as part of the Reich, and these two things weren't the same. These weren't the same undertakings, were they? These weren't the same areas of study for the Reich, were they?
No, it's like, I mean, the whole concept of the Viril Society is like, it's largely a myth. I mean, you have the Thule Society, which is very real, but again, Thule Society, by 1920, Hitler says very, very bluntly, basically, you can either be a member of the Thule Society or a member of the NSDAP, because he has a problem where there's a couple of people who are who are from the very early DAP, which is the organization which became the NSDAP, around 1920. Basically saying, okay, we need a break here, and Nicholas Gudekost basically said point blank that the relationship between the NSDAP and DAP and the Thule Society is there's not really a massive one there. There's just a lot of people who basically want to think there's something there. They're desperate, and it's really caused by one man who is key in it, in Rudolf von Zipporendorf, who basically a quote-unquote occultist who is behind a lot of the origins of the Thule Society, but he's basically writing post-war to make himself out to be this really important guy. The same is true of someone like Jörg von Liebenfels writing in post-war. He says, you know, oh, Hitler was reading my work. He came to visit me in the before the First World War to get, you know, copies that he didn't have, copies of his periodical Stara that he didn't have, and it's basically, it's lots and lots of post-war kind of making people who weren't important feel important because they're trying to secure their legacies at that point. And a lot of people who would have otherwise been able to say, no, you're talking bullshit, weren't in any position to do so, or were dead, or just didn't want to say anything. I mean, there's a lot of people who just wanted to kind of leave that period behind because they wanted to get denazification and just go on with their lives and not be potentially prosecuted by whatever. But it comes back to, you know, there's lots of things like, you know, for example, you mentioned the blonde race. Well, okay, where does the blonde race concept come from? That's really an American concept. That's not a German one at all. Comes from various different American academics who are writing about you know, race and the Indo-European question. Around the 1870s, 1880s, I can't remember the name of the guy, but he was one of the founders of Princeton University, was one of the people who was very heavy. David Starr Jordan, that's the person I'm thinking of. He's one of the people who talked about the blonde race and so on and so forth. The Germans, they didn't really talk in those terms. They would occasionally say the blonde race, but when people say that, that would usually be the popular people like Jörg von Liebenfels. Jörg would often talk about the blonde. He would often talk about the blonde race, but the actual people behind the NSDAP ideology, like the guy in my avatar, Eugen Fischer, who directly inspired Hitler, by the way. He didn't talk in those terms. He talked much more about the Nordish race. He talked about, you know, the different elements of the German race versus, you know, the various Slavics, Slavs, and whatever. So he was talking about those in very different terms. Whereas the blonde concept is something we really, really see turn up in the 30s as like an anti-Nazi, kind of trope,
yes,
where they say, oh yeah, Goebbels looks like none of the NSDAP people look like, you know, the Aryan.
I hear
blonde Aryan
von Braun, right? Like, he's the one I think I hear it mostly spoken about when people talk about von Braun, and it wasn't particularly about this idea of the blue-eyed blonde being the true German or the true Aryan, but it was accusations of them working with people that were from another world. And you know, it sounds crazy, But I hear Von Braun spoken about in this context, that they had some sort of off-world help that was working with them. I don't think they called them the Blondes. I don't know if they called them Pleiadians or some other, you know, sort of off-world, help from elsewhere. And the assertion is always that that they helped with the, you know, with the Hanabu projects. They helped with the other perpetual motion engine or whatever it is. There's another secret project they had that was, you know, incredible. It was supposed to be alien or off-world technology. We're getting right way out into kind of Alex Jones territory here, but this is often attributed to the Nazis for some reason. It's either very defamatory or it's just simply very fantastic. I think you're probably, you know, you're probably right that it's closer to post-Nazi fantasy. But is there any historical context for any of this kind of activity, particularly regarding the UFO projects? Yes. Thank you.
What we think about it is that, okay, so the concept is that the Germans were at the absolute cutting edge of technology. And because of the way the Germans were, particularly from about 43 onwards, they were looking for ways to fight a problem, a particular problem, which was the mass bomber raids. Now, the Germans had this habit of coming, because they had the situation they had, they were coming up with lots and lots of very, very experimental things. We know some of these really, really well because we see them. But the context of like the ME-163 comet, you know, basically a rocket plane. It's not very practical, but the Germans came up with it, they created it, and they used it. Okay, and then you have other things going on. We have the Germans have begun to develop by 44. We've 44, 45. We've begun to see some of the other stuff that's coming out of the German kind of ideas and their scientific base, which the most famous are things like the Horton, I think it was the GO-229, as in the what is today would be called a stealth bomber, a stealth fighter. That is coming. That was very much the flying wing concept. I was absolutely revolutionary at the time. And you have to remember that it was only until the 1980s that the kind of people caught up in many respects. They caught up to what the Germans were up to. And there's a lot of this stuff that occurs in and around this time. Like things like we have the debate around what is the bell? You know, what is this concept? Is this an alien device? No, it's probably. More probably, what it is the Germans are creating a revolutionary concept behind some particular point of, you know, engineering or, you know, creating something. And whether or not it worked, we don't entirely know. We know that the Germans are seriously investigating it. We know the Germans came up with a lot of things that people at the time wouldn't have understood. Most famously, the Germans were towing. Was it rocket? But they were towing missiles behind ships as early as 1942 and launching them. They created anti-air missiles, surface-to-air missiles, air-to-surface missiles. Again, another thing that people often forget is that by 43, 44, the Germans were routinely arming a lot of the night fighters and their fighters over defending Germany with rockets. And if you watch the series Masters of the Air, you'll see that all of a sudden you'll see the Germans will just come towards an American formation, and they'll just fire a huge amount of rockets, and it just completely it would decimate American and British aerial formations. So a lot of the stuff that's going on, the Germans are producing all this stuff really, really quickly because they have to. So this is why we start to see some really weird stuff come towards the end. You see the Germans in 1945. They're using night fighter technology. They're using infrared technology. They've got infrared new technology on guns, on tanks. They've got what is it? They've got guns that shoot around corners. They've got all this kind of weird stuff. It really turns up, particularly in the last major German offensive in the West, the famous Operation Watch on the Rhine. And so what's happening is that in this post-war world, The Americans, the British, the French, which is kind of the French were actually doing it as well, which people forget, and then the Soviet Union, all came into Germany and all tried to steal as much of the space, the scientific base as possible, because this was the cutting edge of everything. You have to remember that a lot of the Soviet bomb program came from the German bomb program. A lot of what became this NASA came from the Germans. A lot of technology that became staples of the of American life and even life now, came from the Germans in this time. I mean, we get microwaves, for example. That's a German technology from around the war, the war era. So
Yes.
when we talk about these UFOs and this kind of thing, what you're really seeing, to my mind, is you're seeing people in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and well into the 80s and 90s, misattributing things that were happening. The Germans were doing quite rationally. To basically as like really really fast development of really advanced cutting edge stuff and concepts as being alien technology. It's not alien technology. It's just the Germans being very well German, for lack of a better term, because this is what they were doing. You have to remember the German economy was it actually massively outproducing itself. It till very, very late in the war, it was really booming in a big, big way, and you see all these kind of stuff that's come out of it. Some of the best tanks of the war come out of the of this period. Like, for example, the Hetzer, which is a Czech tank. But all this stuff comes out of it, but yet we think of the Germans very much as being. We kind of hold this narrative of them around 43, 44. We don't see that into war from 44, 45, the Germans make a step change, and you start seeing all sorts of really, really advanced stuff coming out because the Germans are trying to find a way to end the war, win the war quickly, or at least hold people off long enough to get a peace. So basically, it's what would happen. Like, say, for example. Say for example, Russia invaded the U.S. Today. The Russians came were advancing across the U.S. and they'd got to, maybe they got to nearly towards D.C. What would then happen, Vlad? When you think about it, is that a lot of the stuff that DARPA and people like that, a lot of the stuff that they would have produced, they produced in the meantime. Would you'd begin to see that coming out. You'd start to see the ray guns, you'd see the sonic weapons, you would see the rail guns, you would see whatever they've got in there coming out and being used. And the same thing would probably happen. People would be completely confused. I mean, what on earth is this? Is this alien technology? No, it's just you're seeing at the front, you're seeing the advanced experimental stuff coming out from before it's really been like kind of nailed down and made into a usable concept. It's being deployed on the battlefield. So that to me is where this all comes from. And then you have the rise of the flying saucer movement in the 40s. You add that all together and you see the Germans were coming up with something, had something called the Bell. And it's quite clear that it kind of looked like, from what they've got, it looks like kind of looks like a flying saucer to some degree. And people are saying, well, people are adding two and two together, and they get maybe four, but they also maybe get five. And people often don't
Yes.
assume they assume they get four, but in fact, have they got five? That's what I'd always caution people around this.
We go back to Occam's razor again, right?
Yeah. What is the simplest solution to the problem? Is it aliens, or is it just that you are seeing the experimental stuff coming out of the German organizations, research organizations that are? This is why. To give you an example of infrared, when the Germans had the infrared sights on their guns, it was almost a war winner in itself, weirdly enough, because the Germans were going around at the At night in the Ardennes during the German last offensive in the West, what became the Battle of the Bulge, basically with large lamps, infrared lamps mounted on MG 42s, and they were just going around looking where the Americans were and just machine gunning them. So it's that kind of thing of like people don't really understand how revolutionary this was and how much this absolutely terrified American troops. Because, I mean, they've never seen this before. They've never seen people who could see them in the dark and then see exactly where they were, and like as if it's light and machine gun them, but they can't see them. They can't do anything backwards. It's that kind of, you have to go back and say, how would I feel if, or how would I look at, it's like that whole concept of the technology to a certain level looks like magic.
Yeah, and they
And
couldn't
that
believe it.
is, to me, what you're.
Well, they couldn't believe it at first, and then
Yeah.
after the war, right? It's a great tactic of disempowering and de, you know, kind of degrading their actual ability, their talent, their skill, their engineering prowess. It's a great way to smear them just by giving all the credit for their incredible ingenuity to aliens, right?
Yeah, but it's
Post-war.
also a way to it's a way to avoid to say that, oh, by the way, our enemy had some really, really good tech, really
Yeah, and
advanced
we got
technology,
spanked. Yes.
and we almost lost bits of the war because of it. In the same way that, I mean, most Americans that are completely unaware of battles like the Hurt Gun Forest, where it's the bloodiest battle in American history, but most people have no idea about it because the American military establishment is so, we're so embarrassed about it. We're so embarrassed about what happened in the Battle of Hurt Gun Forest. They basically covered it up because the Americans went into a meat grinder with the Germans, and the Germans basically, had the Germans had any kind of real resources at that point, would have spanked them. But as it was, the Germans basically put the Americans in the meat grinder, and the Americans lost huge amounts of troops. And like a Russian, like an Eastern Front kind of scenario, and so much so that it's generally regarded as one of the worst battles that the American military has ever fought. That kind of thing.
Very, very interesting. And man, just what an awesome and enlightening conversation we're having. We're talking to Carl Rattle, of course, if you showed up late. Carl Rattle, professor of history, expert on the Reich, National Socialist, and an incredible genius. And if I may just be, if I can undersell it just a little bit for him. But Carl, you, I wanted to just breeze by the protocols. Just for a minute, I don't want to go into anything that you want to avoid, but I had made an audiobook out of the Nihilist edition of the Protocols, and of course, drawing heavily most of my knowledge from an article that you wrote that I've got on your Substack up here on the screen. And you've gone very, very deeply into the protocols and the origins. Of course, one of the first problems I found when I tried to do the protocols is I thought, well, I want to go find the original version. You know, as with as little translation as possible, only to find out that that is a rabbit hole in and of itself, one that you have gone down quite a bit here, and you've covered almost everything that we know about the protocols. And I think the last time we had spoken, you had mentioned the possibility of having access to the original Znamia articles, because I think most people really only attribute Khrushchev. I think they'll go back as far as Khrushchev. Before Nihilus, but you don't hear much about the Znamia articles. Obviously, they're not easy to find. I looked for them online, and I thought, well, I'm going to get my hands on these, but this turned out to be impossible, even with all of the amazing deep research that AI is capable of now. And you must have had to pull some strings if you managed to get a hold of these. But I think you had mentioned that you may or may not have been able to source that material, and possibly even get that translated. This is a long-term project, and this is something I know that you're not done with yet, but I kind of tend to want to sensationalize everything, and I think that you might be working on something really historical here if you're successful at it. But can you elaborate any on that project, or kind of how that's going, or is that something that's going to take you, like, is that something you feel will take a very long time, or something that you'll have to maybe be very, very careful about doing, as because of what we talked about before with talking about unpopular things.
No, I think it's fairly well known that I've had an interest in the Protocols for quite a while because I bumbled onto Cezar de Michelis's The Non-Existent Manuscript over well over a decade, nearly 2 decades ago, I think, and it kind of changed how I thought about the Protocols basically overnight, because it's one it's pro an epoch making study of them. And kind of as to go, yeah, we because he actually includes the reason we have the Zemania, and we have the other things and the Krishivan editions is because of Demichelis's. He actually includes them. He includes the various different versions of the protocols in his the as an appendix to his the non-existent manuscript. So that's currently being translated at the moment by Otto, actually. So the truth is that once that is done, that then just needs notes. It needs Demichelis's notes plus mine plus any Otto wants to. What is the mix to explain things or to read it and to kind of try and make sense of it, and then to take that and then say, okay, how do we understand this? Because not only have we kind of come into a new phase in the study of the protocols of Zion, we've also really begun to validate a lot more information around them. And really, the person who's done that is Michael Hagemeister. Who's an academic, who's anti-protocols, but he's a very good academic archival historian who's worked through a lot of what people would call the backstory or the prehistory of the protocols of Zion, where they come from, and also who the figures are. Because as you probably know, Flood, a lot of the people who get involved in it, it's a quite a motley cast of people.
Yes.
But what happens? Something that Hagemeister really dug through, and it's very recent. It's 2022, I think he published his book on it, his last monograph on it, was that you've got these people who people reference that. Okay, why do we have the evidence we've got? Well, we actually have the evidence we've got because of the 1935 to 1930, I think it's 35 to 37 Berne trial of the protocols between basically. The NSDAP versus the NSDAP and French anti-Jewish researchers around Monsignor Youal, who was a Catholic priest, and also people that people may be familiar with, a writer called L. Fry, who was actually Elizabeth Shishimarov, I think her name was, but her maiden name is Fry. She has her own little weird backstory, but between them all, they came up with nearly all of the witnesses that we have. Not only that, the other side in that, the Jewish side, come up with a their own witness, their own two witnesses, who are used to this day to try and prove that it was all a conspiracy by the Aklana. But the problem is that these two witnesses are talking years afterwards. They say they saw something. There's no evidence they saw it. And both of them are known to be con men, or one con woman, one con man. And you have a scenario where this story of they were plagiarized from the they were plagiarized from what's his name, the dialogues in hell by the dialogues in hell by Moresh Joly, is complete nonsense, because. What you get this idea that the Aklana basically plagiarized this, but in truth, this is a theory by a man from a man called Boris Nikolaevsky in the 20s and 30s, who which, this theory was then seized upon by lawyers, not by historians or researchers, by lawyers in the Berne libel case on the protocols to be because they needed a convincing narrative. So what did they do? They take a particular claim, they try and substantiate it, and then they link back into various different people. One of the people involved in that case was Alexander Targa, who was a anti who was a pro-Jewish researcher in the Soviet archives, who also comes up with some of the stuff that they use to claim make this claim. And Hagemeister did quite a lot of work around this and basically pointed out that it's complete and utter bullshit that these people. Came up with this narrative. It's complete and utter crap. There's no involvement with the Akrana whatsoever. And if you look at the historians of the Akrana, they've been of this opinion since the 1980s. They've said this. They said this. This claim by Norman Cohn, who was a Jewish academic who plagiarized Nikolaevsky, claimed his research as his own, and didn't cite him. basically is complete gobblers because it does, there's no support for it in the Okhrana's archives whatsoever. There's, it doesn't make any sense with the Okhrana, with how the Okhrana worked. There's no, in, and the, even the narrative itself doesn't make any sense in terms of the history of the Okhrana. Essentially, you have a situation where the protocols, and all of a sudden, the protocols, such as they are, fall apart as a narrative. The traditional narrative just falls apart.
Yes.
So the other aspect of this, I don't think I made, I don't mention it before, but the other aspect, the other famous aspect is what we call Mr. X. And Mr. X is a is was a Russian emigre. We know his name. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. Who is in Constantinople at the time, who met a man, I can't remember his name now, who met basically, sorry, it's Philip something or other, a British journalist for the Times, who goes to Istanbul and then magically meets him, calls him Mr. X, and says, oh, he gave me this pamphlet which says, oh yeah, that the the protocols were invented and based upon this and whatever. There's a lot of problems with that because, first of all, how did Mr. X know that? Second of all, language. Now, this is something I've really, really tried to get people to think about and to kind of bring up a lot more in their debates whenever this comes up, is to say, well, okay, so they are plagiarizing all these this work, right? Okay, so what? So where are they plagiarizing? Because Philip was his name, can't remember his name. He then. Basically, he in his pamphlet, he never says which language he's working in. He doesn't say I'm working in English. He just produces these excerpts. He says I've got a French book, and I've got an English edition. Because remember this time that he's working from an English he's working from an English language protocols, and a French book that he allegedly has from the in Constantinople, and he's comparing the two. He, well, okay, so. The protocols at this point of his life is allegedly a translation of a French document into Russian, and the Russian is then translated into English. And then, so that's two translations.
Right,
And then
that
he's
makes
then
sense.
claiming that he's comparing a French to an English, or an English or another trans or an English to a French, whichever. So there's a three additional there's an additional translation somewhere in that. So basically you're comparing probably at something you're comparing a translation of a translation against a translation, or you're comparing an original against a translation of a translation of a translation. That's not a good argument. That's really bad. And the reason this is kind of important is because that just completely nukes the parallels argument that of oh, this passage says this, so this passage says this. But you're not comparing original documents, you're comparing translation, you're translations of translations of translations. And we know a lot of the we know the translation into English was bad because, for example, the famous passage of the they're undermining the cities, they're there's been huge amounts of ink spilled on this by academics. The truth is, it's just a bad translation. The original Russian doesn't say that. The original Russian actually says, oh, they are being subversive. They're undermining the state. Not they're undermining cities, not that they're going,
That
but
they're
because
digging
there's
tunnels
been,
under Cleveland, yeah.
yeah, they're digging tunnels. And so, yeah, it's that whole thing of it. Once you do that again, it comes back to the simplest solution, not the some random, like, oh, it prevents the, how, the Jews threaten masculinity and the state. And it's like, oh my God.
Well, this
But
is
that's the
in,
point,
it's
is that,
intense. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. You
Okay.
essentially, we have this understanding of the protocols, which is generally, I think I agree with you that it's most likely dead wrong. But there's an opportunity that you could do work that kind of takes away the idea that these came from Herzl, that this was the result of the Jewish World Congress, or just many of the things that are just assumed nowadays to be the origins of this. This could blow all
Yeah.
that stuff into pieces, right? I mean, you could disintegrate our understanding of the protocols and where they came from as it is now. And it sounds like you've got, I mean, you put a lot of work into this article, and I recommend everybody check out Carl Rattle's Substack, where he literally dis he just he disassembles all of these arguments very methodically, very systematically, in about 70 or 80 pages, it seems. And this is a work in progress. So what I thought was interesting about it was, you know, after talking to Otto, who essentially has trouble finding work and, you know, is trying to find that way to, you know, to kind of break in or break out or break into another strata and maybe, you know, be able to, you know, live on his profession. He actually has the opportunity here to do something I think that's pretty historic. And I know that most of the people listening to this show would be highly, highly interested in any sort of revision to the protocols or the story behind them. And so, you know, just in my mind, it's just putting two and two together and making it make four that it would, you know, that's where his, I want to say that's what he should be working on, but that's a very, crude, I think, simplification of it. I'm sure that there are hurdles. There are things that you have to do. Like you said, it's got to be noted. It's probably got to be reviewed. But there's a really good opportunity here to make some history, in my opinion, when it comes to the protocols. That's not something people get a chance to do every day. Could that lead to a better position for, you know, for him or yourself, or it could just lead to headaches and problems?
I think it can lead to both. I mean, I think any opportunity like this, it's you have to ask the question, am I prepared to deal with the consequences?
Yes.
Because it's some of those things. I'm pretty sure Otto doesn't care. I don't either. But it's more of a case of, you know, are you prepared to deal with potentially some people coming after you because you've basically blown open a 100-year-old mystery that they had tried very much to hide. And the reason that I kind of brought up Mr. X is because Mr. X and Philip Cumbers, I just can't remember the surname, the British journalist who's actually a member of British intelligence. He was a member of the famous Arab office. So the Arab Bureau in the war in the Middle East, which is where we get Lawrence of Arabia. But the Arab Bureau is very famously pro-Zionist. Now, why would all of a sudden someone with links to British intelligence, because remember, a lot of British intelligence people at the time were either had side gigs or were basically full-time journalists during the peacetime. Famously, Kim Philby was like that. Kim Philby was a journalist for a long time. He wrote for the Times, among other things. And basically, as a had a cover as a Soviet agent, as a normal British, you know, intelligence officer, who happened to also be a journalist, which is again quite common. So you have a situation where you have a British basically spy who all of a sudden finds this amazing evidence at the height of the protocol's popularity, and then he quote unquote debunks the protocols by this particular bit of research or whatever. But what's going on around this time? This is just after the Balfour Declaration. This is just after the Bolshevik Revolution. This is the absolute height of anti-Semitism in the 20s. And there's a huge problem because all of a sudden Jews are deploying anyone they can find, like they are today, to try and get rid of this, to shut it up, you know, disprove this, do something, because this is so dangerous. It's spreading so fast. It's so effective. And what happens? All of a sudden, they magically come up with this particular claim. And it's then trumpeted around the world as if it's genuine. And it's the fact that it comes up when it does and who it comes from, and plus it's of how odd the claim is, it just doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense from any means. And we also know from the later in the 30s, the British intelligence did do this, and they also did it to the Irish. So during the Civil War in Ireland, so the Irish struggle for independence in Ireland from 1918 to, I think it's 21. So this is around exactly the same time. British intelligence deliberately would claim that the Fenians were part of a Jewish international conspiracy or linked to Freemasonry as part of their black propaganda. Because one of the things that people forget about the British, particularly British intelligence in World War I and World War II, is that it was incredibly focused towards black propaganda. It was very good at it. So they've essentially taken something and they've tried, and to me, they've taken something that was a threat and they've tried and they've neutralized it by coming up with black propaganda saying, oh, it's a complete myth. It's a myth, you know, it's a threat. Because they wanted to create a Zionist state in what is now Israel and Palestine. because of the fact they had this weird commitment, this weird idea of what Winston Churchill would talk about later, well, kind of around the same time, talked about the concept of the good Jews, which is the Zionist Jews, versus the bad Jews, as in the Bolshevik Jews. And this would then they would then be the idea was then they would be grateful to Britain, and then they would be you know they promote they would be this bastion in the Middle East for British interests, which, as we know from later, very quickly was disabused, because the Jews immediately basically began bombing and murdering British soldiers as much as anyone else, by the middle of kind of the mid to late 20s. But it doesn't stop the fact that this was what was believed at the time. So essentially, you have a situation where an intelligence organization has nuked the protocols. We don't really know this until relatively recently because of Hagemeyer's work in and around the protocols and the prehistory of the protocols, because he validated something else. That so another common trope is this idea of Madame Justine Golinka in Paris, and that it comes from her. From a Jew named Schorst. But what Hagemeyer did was go back and he validated that A, Justine Golinka was real. She was in Paris at the time. She did have correspondence. She wasn't close to the Tsar, whatever, but she wanted to be. But she did know a Jew named Ephraim Schorst. And Ephraim Schorst was a very, very real person. He was possibly a con man, but he may also have actually been linked to somewhat into Freemasonry. So what Hagemeister has argued, and he's argued, he basically said, I don't have enough evidence for it, but the other possible origin is exactly what it appeared, what it was, what the all the anti-Semites in the 20s around Monseigneur Juon and his Revue d'International Société Secrète basically argued. So they got it right, and all the Jews and all the people claiming that it was a big, big Russian conspiracy and to defame the Jews, but they were completely blown out of the water. But we don't have enough evidence for that yet. But there is, you've got two basic points, both of which validate the anti-Semitic and pro-protocols position, not the not the philo-Semitic pro-Jewish position. So to me, is that you have a lot of scope for this to get traction and for people to begin to see the protocols in a new light, in the same way that we've got to look at a lot of things in a new light. We've got to look at this information. We've got to look at this. We've got to look at this history in a different way, because what we believe, what is claimed, is often it's complete nonsense without the context. If we don't have the microhistorical work which says, ah, this is why this is happening, then we can't really just take that for granted. And this is why I kind of come back to always, always context is vital. Without the context of remarks, without the context of what's happening, without knowing the situation, then we have to assume that there's possibly more there than not, but we need the context. Without that, we don't have anything. And this is kind of why I do like to use the term lacunae, because I think it's good for people to know unusual terms. But also, I think it's people doing the right terms of things. And lacunae is a very, very good way of putting it, very succinct way of doing it. But also, it kind of points to the fact that we need history to make sense. And the only way history makes sense is with the context. And with the protocols, it suddenly makes sense. Because all of a sudden, you've got a document that has the original protocols, the main document it's really quoting. Is design is the Zionist manifesto? Sorry, Herzl's the Zionist manifesto. So that's essentially what you have a situation with. So they don't want to talk about they want to talk about Joly's was it Dialogues in Hell, but they don't want to talk about the fact that it heavily quotes the Zionist Theodor Herzl. Why? Because all of a sudden, 1902, there is just before the protocols comes to light, we have the All Russian Zionist Conference, which happens in and around, I think it's Minsk. So there's a lot of context to this, and all of a sudden it starts to be very different, because we're adding this context and we're realizing, oh, by the way, there's all this there's all this additional information we're not told, because it makes the anti-protocols case look ridiculous. And it's kind of true in general with history that if you don't, without the context, without the particular points of information, history looks completely different. And it's like the whole thing to do with why did the Germans do what they did in the road to war? Well, because they're reacting to certain things. Why does Kristallnacht happen if we assume the traditional narrative is correct? It happens because there has been 3 to 4 murders of German diplomats by Jews that have occurred at this point, political murders across Europe and the United States in the years before. So what happens? The Germans respond with X. Now, I think that's wrong. I think there's actually another case that needs to be dealt with, and that's another thing for Kristallnacht. But it's very interesting that people will leave this information out, because if we're leaving it out, it looks completely differently to when you add it in. When you add it in, all of a sudden, you see that the way that it's being interpreted is wrong. It's quite obviously wrong at that. So to me, that's the key of a lot of information to do with the protocols, to do with the Reich, to do with history in general. We talked about, we talked about other things to do with history. And the great thing, another great example, if you want to go back all the way back in history to the Romans, is okay. So the Romans were so bigoted against the Jews. Well, why did the Romans expel the Jew? Why did the Roman Republic expel the Jews in 139 BC then, for subverting the state, quite literally, with religion? So again, they don't want to talk about that one, because all of a sudden they have to explain, okay, A, why were there Jews in Rome in 139 BC? B, why are Jews subverting the state with religion? They're not supposed to be trying to convert anyone to it. And C, what does this mean in terms of the later references to Jews and Jewish power in Rome and how it worked? And all of a sudden, it makes everything different, because you have to then account for this other information, this other context. And it comes back to just, honest history.
Man, there's a
I'm
lot
sorry, I've
under the
gone on a
rug.
bit.
Yes, they've swept a lot under the rug, and you risk exposing what's under the rug, and then they have to, and then that needs to be answered for. That needs to be explained as well. I'm excited about this. I mean, to me, I'm not only kind of a conspiracy theorist, but of course, I've spent a lot of time looking at the protocols and turning it into an audio book, and just the idea of not being able to find an original kind of drove me nuts. And I started to understand it once I read your article. Your article extremely well written. I can't recommend people who are interested in the protocols. I can't recommend enough to read Carl's article on the protocols on his Substack. And I think it's potentially, like it's bombshell stuff, even if it minimizes or takes away from the idea of a grand conspiracy. As long as it's more truthful and it brings more things to light, brings more context into light, I'd rather be right than be sensational, right? I mean, that's really what we're after here is the truth.
Yeah, because that's what really history is about, isn't it? It's
Yes.
about knowing the truth. And also, it serves us the best in terms of getting people to understand how the future, what the future is, because if they understand the past well, they can then see what's happened in the past truly, and they can then say, well, the future needs to look like this, because I realize that what's been done in the past, what mistakes have been in the past, but also I can identify the problem, because I have the context for why the modern world looks the way it does versus from that period. It's that whole post-war consensus thing. Because why are the Germans the big enemy? Why do we have the Cold War? Why does the Cold War then generate the 1960s? Why does everything that happened since then, and why does the 60s then generate the 80s, and the revanche of the libertarians and the pro-business, the taking over of the American and European right by laissez-faire capitalists, and then we get this kind of like a term golem of leftist academics and leftist businessmen or whatever, combined with good old-fashioned corporate interests promoting both the same thing, and doing it in a very ideologically and profit-driven way. Why are they doing it? Because you have these stages that are coming through those years, all going back to 1945. Why 1945? Because that's the year zero, the year null of modernity. That's when everything changes. All of a sudden, all the empires are gone. Europe is dead, and we end up with this new world that we want to create. And that's when the mass immigration starts. That it's simply it's around then. That's when you get Windrush. That's when you get the beginning of the race doesn't exist, and Europeans are not Europeans are scum, and
The Jew World
we
Order,
need to
right?
get
I
rid
call
of
it the
them.
Jew World
Yeah,
Order.
but that's it. I mean, that's where it comes from. But why does it come about? Because of 1940, because of the end of the Second World War and National Socialism. And why does that come about? Because of Jewish actions in 1917 to the 1930s. So again, it's all linked together. But once you realize it's all linked together, then you realize that the problem isn't it isn't the far right. It isn't Europeans. The problem is the Jew and the Jews and people who support them, the people who have been paid by them. And every time it's like that. It's like that the old adage: every time you lift up a particular problem, you must invariably find Jews. You find them in lots of weird places they shouldn't be. It's like, when I was digging into the abortion issue in Ohio, the abortion vote in Ohio, I wasn't expecting there to be a ton of Jewish impact. I knew there'd be some, but I just didn't know a ton. And then I worked it out. It was like 70 to 80% of all the money that flooded into the pro-abortion thing was from Jews. And then none of it on the anti-abortion side came from Jews. That in itself is very, very, that kind of thing is really telling. And you find it again and again and again. And that's what I mean by, that's what we say, we talk about pattern recognition, is that when you're always finding the same people in the same, like, disproportionate, weird situation, involved in these things, and they're not involved in positivity, but they're not involved in positive things, but they're invariably involved in really, really bad things.
That's
And
true. You
then
don't
they
find them
say,
involved in like leaving gifts for anybody, or they're just plague blankets, right? I mean, they're always up to something terrible, horrible, unimaginably terrible.
yes, and usually it's something completely off the wall. I mean, someone was digging into this, and they looked into the who is behind, the assisted suicide legislation push in Britain. And they went back, and they, looking to see who it was. And of course, they got back to, oh, it's a couple of Jewish businessmen and Jewish academics. It's like, oh my, it's that whole thing. It becomes very predictable, but at the same time, really, really upsetting, because you
Wow.
realize, and you're just like, wow, it's like the how do you approach a subject like this? And then they say, oh, we didn't do anything wrong, really. The reason people might have rose against you so much is because you did things like this. And then you go back in history and you look at the you can see, did they do this? And yes, so what happened? So why did they get kicked out of, why did they get kicked out of X place? Oh, because they basically turned up and they ruined the economy. They ruined the economy, or they impoverished people, they starved people to death deliberately. Rather, from their own greed, they didn't have to, but they did. So, what do they think is going to happen? It comes back to, it's like Benjamin Ginsberg's point in The Fatal Embrace, that fundamentally a lot that Jews have done. He puts it like Jews have been caught in the middle all the time, between the elite and the people at the bottom. And I tend to agree they are caught in the middle. He thinks it's because it's all basically it's just because Jews are upwardly mobile and whatever. I would say no, it's because they're a natural client class to a lot of traditional governments, but they're also very, very unscrupulous. They generate resentment in ways that no one else seems to. And they do it consistently throughout time, throughout space, throughout civilizations, throughout religions. The accusations, the points, the claims about them are pretty much consistent. Occasionally they shift, but not a lot. I mean, the same points come up again and again and again. And you go to modernity again, you look and see what they're doing today, and you see the same points again. What do? They try and they try and subvert everything to make it pro them. Or they try and make people kind of work for them in the view that they are some special, unique people that are basically the, I called them Red Sea pedestrians the other day. But the truth is that they believe themselves to be the people that, to be the gods, you know, the children, the chosen people of the creator of the universe, which. There is a certain amount of hubris involved in that
A little
particular
bit,
claim.
a little bit. But man, I know we've blown past the 2 hour mark here, and I know that you don't have infinite time, but I want to say thank you. There are a few people that have sent in donations, and I want to make sure it's in case there are any questions that they have that we get a chance to answer them, or at least,
Yeah, sure.
pass their compliments along. Jared Martin says his mind is blown, but in a good way, and he says thank you very much, Carl. And hopefully we're going to get some people to take a look at your Substack. Maybe if you guys are very kind, if it's possible, be sure and subscribe to Carl, man. Help him do this kind of work. He's involved in a lot of things. Let's see. He gave us $50 and says that he's broke, right? So that sounds like a trope to
Yeah.
me, by the way, Jared. It's kind of funny, interestingly, that you mentioned Ohio because it turns out, coincidentally, they actually are tunneling under Cleveland.
Are they?
Under every kabod, they find these tunnels, man. And there's probably mattresses in them. That's crazy talk. Let's see, super chats over here. Giuseppe Vaffanculo says hello. He says Flood and Carl, elite wide content. Thank you very much, G-Man, Giuseppe. And we had a fantastic show last week with G-Man. Go check it out. It's from his Wednesday show of the Sane Asylum. Vale of Shadow says,
Yep.
great guest, very knowledgeable. Vale of Shadows is he's our amateur historian, and he's got a lot of hard work up on Gab. Night Nation Review sent us a donation. This is Heil Flood and Professor Carl. You're going to be doing Night Nation Review on Wednesday, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Awesome. We're going to be looking for Carl Rattle over on Night Nation Review here in a couple of days. Skin says, a great show, brother. Great and great chat. And Huntress, of course, a big fan of yours, and I'm sure you have hers, says thank you, Carl, for revising revisionism. So I think we've got most of those. We've got all the super chats anyway. I didn't really see any. I love the good interviews. There's not a lot of questions because you have a natural way of covering a lot of ground and addressing things that people are going to ask before they get a chance to ask them. I call it a pre-sponse, but I'm sure that there's a real name for that. Also, you're just like you're really naturally good at this. We got into a little bit of kind of the search for the search for the Aryan origins and sort of Aryan mysticism. This is something I could spend 10, 20 hours talking about, but I hope that we'll get a chance to do this again. And I'd kind of like to focus on that specifically, because there's a lot of lacunae, right, around the events that happened, around what the Germans were looking into, what they did find, and what they derived from that information. And I think a lot of us are just fascinated in this. I'm particularly fascinated in the existence of an Aryan form of mysticism, or a form of mysticism that was for and by our people. And then we talked briefly about the Orlinda book, and I want to kind of probe what more you know about that in the future. Hopefully we can get an opportunity to have that discussion. And of course, we have you coming back at least monthly anyway. So, man, just thanks for being such an awesome guest. And if there's anything that you want to
Become
bring up
fucking jacked as
or
fuck
ask, oh, we're
with
getting a
hate.
donation over on Entropy from Hun
Hell of a
Blondie.
show, fellas.
She says, hell of a
O
show.
slash.
I think you've got a new fan. She's discovered your Substack tonight. And thank you, Blondie, for supporting our show and for your kind words. And I know that Carl appreciates he appreciates all the well wishing and man, just people listen to people for people to listen to you is one thing. For them to be enthralled is a completely different thing. That's something that you're very good at. Anything that you want to cover? Anything that you want to discuss? I could just go on asking questions. I guess we should ask, like, where's the best way to find you? What's the best way to follow you? And of course, you're free to take the floor as long as you'd like to, or have anything that you want to say or talk about.
If anyone wants to talk, I'm at Carl Rattle on X, and then the Substack, of course. Again, you don't have Substack is completely free. You don't have to subscribe. You don't have to pay any money. That's one of the things that I very much adhere to. I do not want people spending their hard-earned money just because, you know, support me or whatever it is, support my work. I don't need it. But anything if you want to do it, I'm completely fine with it. I allow it to happen. But because when I didn't allow it, I actually get people being quite upset, which is quite a bizarre scenario for me.
It's a way of gracefully receiving, you know, people's appreciation, I think.
It's just kind of like, okay, well, I'll just allow it and then just see what happens. But yeah, I think it's one of these things that I think there's a lot of people out there who they basically put out what is called slop, and they'll say things that are not accurate in order to get people to, you know, keep them on the hook and whatever. And that's something I try to avoid. I try not to be dishonest about anything. I try to be honest, even when I don't like the response, even when I'm challenged on things, and I am occasionally challenged on things to say, you know, why do you believe this? And sometimes it's genuine because I've never seen it before, and I have to go away and I have to work it out. It's like that. I got a photo of a pillar it's a pillar without any context. With the claim from the NSDAP era, where it's claimed that it shows a Freemasonic symbol. And it took, I think it was 2 hours for everyone to, for me and about two or three other people on X to work out what it was. Because going backwards through it, trying to work out, okay, what is this thing? Because it doesn't make any sense. There's no context. Just said, oh, it's Freemasonry. Okay. And then I thought it was one thing. I thought it was a symbol with a series of symbols on it. And it's got the the German Workers' Front symbol on it. And then there's this whole series of symbols. And it didn't make a lot of sense. And then one of them kind of looked like the Freemasonry symbol. And then I thought it was the German Labor Corps. Symbol, which is weird. It kind of does look like it, but then someone realized it was actually the German Carpenters Association. So they have a particular symbol, and it kind of looks somewhat like the Freemason symbol. The kind of the cross keys and whatever, and so the compasses and whatever. But it's not that at all. If you actually go and dig into it, it looks rather different. It just from a distance, it kind of looks similar, and then all the other symbols are German craft guilds. And if you look at them in order, all of a sudden it's the German foresters, it's the German carpenters, it's the German house builders, and then you've got the DAP, the German Left Front. So they're basically saying we are building up into the Reich as part of the symbology, but it'd been taken one way. And it's that whole thing of I'm getting something thrown at me that I've never seen before. I've got to work out what this is, but you can do it quite quickly. And particularly with people who will just help out because they're interested. They'll kind of work out and they'll work out who it is. Cause it wasn't my discovery that it was the German carpenters. I thought it was something else. And they came up and they said, ah, it looks like this. And it's like, ah, that makes perfect sense. And all of a sudden you work back and you get, and you work out what it is. And there is an immense amount of satisfaction you get from that kind of work. Or certainly I do.
Man, you're right. That's very close. I've got it up on screen, and I would have probably, you could have sold me on Freemasonry, but obviously, right, a tradesman's guild. And yep, very, very close. I enjoy that kind of stuff too. It's nice to get in on a debunk here and there, right, as a historian probably.
Yeah, it's kind of fun because you learn things. I mean, it's why I've been debunking Jewish inventions partly, because I learned lots of random things I didn't know before, because I've started to dig in things and gone, oh, okay, I didn't realize that. I didn't realize that the origin of like bingo was in Italy, or the bagel originally comes from Germany, from a German Italian Roman bread. Yeah.
Jews wrecked. Yeah. You guys got Jews wrecked. We're just, you know what? They're just like niggers. They're always stealing everybody's inventions, calling it their own.
Yeah, and the one I found literally today. So you know the game Yahtzee?
Yeah, everybody knows Yahtzee.
Yeah, and that was a legend. They claim that as a Jewish invention because because a Jew named Edwin Lowe, invented it and then created it in the 50s and late 40s. The truth is that's basically a complete con, because it's basically him. He stole an extant game called the Yacht Game, and which is where Yahtzee comes from. And then he basically passed it off as his own. So it's similar to bingo, in that bingo, Jews claim they invented bingo. The truth is the Italians invented bingo. The Jews just then claimed that they invented it and tried to patent it. The same way that Barbie is a German invention, but a Jew went over to Germany and basically nicked the German doll concept, and it became Barbie in the US. Same is true with the ballpoint pen. The ballpoint pen, it comes from an American inventor named John Loud. And then Laszlo Biro took the idea, added in a different kind of ink, and then we get the Biro, the ballpoint pen.
Wait, I thought Anne Frank invented the ballpoint pen. Was it Anne Frank? No, I'm of course joking, but you're right. And Yahtzee clearly doesn't have six dice. There's only five, so it's not Jewish. And because everything they do is six, right? And so they would have six dice.
They like sixes.
Yep. Five dice, definitely not Jewish.
Yeah, it's just when you go into it and you start looking at all these different things and all these different aspects to the problem, how and their history and what they claim to have done and what they claim or they actually did, you start to realize that their path, that Hitler is fundamentally right. That when you look at them and you realize that what they tend to do is they tend to use the big lies. They say they make a big claim, and they don't support that claim. Then they won't support it, but also they'll also say, "Oh yeah, we invented the defibrillator." No, you didn't. That had already been invented by the time Paul Zoll came up with his machine. So this whole thing of you go into it and you realize, well, actually, all this stuff is not as nearly as dry, as cut and dried as they claim it to be, and they basically say, I'm gonna claim this as a Jewish invention, but then you look into it and you realize no, it's not. But then it's you have to work backwards to say, well, no, you have to challenge them directly and say, no, you're lying. And whenever you do that, what you watch what happens. They run. They don't like it at all, because all of a sudden they're on the back foot. They've got to do research. They've got to try and debunk you. And because you've already done the research, you know they're wrong. So all of a sudden they're stuck arguing a bunch of lies that are repeated ad nauseum by, you've got like Israeli newspapers like Israel Hayom mentions it. You've got Aish, which is a reformed Jewish site, talks about it, and so on and so forth. So you've got all this, you've got all these different Jewish sources all claiming the same thing, but it's all incestuous. It's all them, you know, they're citing each other. And eventually what you often find is that even the best of them make absolutely stupid mistakes, which is the best of them is probably JInfo, which actually tries to make some kind of basis to the claims. And you dig into their stuff and you realize that, oh yeah, that a lot of their stuff is completely cobblers, or it is dishonest, or it's basically not quite as it would appear to be. A good example would be JInfo's claim that the Christian French philosopher Michael de Montaigne was Jewish. He wasn't. I've addressed that particular claim because it's complete gobbler if you actually bother to look at it. The claim is based upon just assumptions that you can't justify. from the literature. You just can't justify it. The same is true of people like Cervantes. You've got basically a whole series of Spanish doctors and doctors of the church in the Counter-Reformation who are claimed as Jewish, who aren't, but St. John of the Cross, St. John of God, Teresa of Avila. They're all not Jewish, but yet they're claimed as such based upon very, very lousy research and lousy claims. This is the same basis behind the whole Columbus thing. It's saying, oh, he was Jewish. No, he's not. He was Genoese. And, all this sort of, crap that they come up with every so often. It's annoying, but it's also fun because it's fun to debunk it. It's kind of, Carlo Mottone kind of said the same thing about the Holocaust. He said, basically, it's annoying because they come up with so much crap all the time. But then when you go into the detail and you go into it and you debunk it, the response, it feels amazing, but also the response is hilarious because they don't know what to do. They don't know how to deal with it.
You've also got a series. Okay, so you guys, if you go check out Carl's Substack, he's clearly got a series of debunks where he's debunking Jewish claims. He's debunking Jewish invention claims. You also seem to have a very strong line of Jewish child molesters that you've exposed here. You're doing so a lot of spotlights on Jew. There are a lot of Jewish child molesters here on this page, man. I see at least a dozen. You have been very hard at work, sir, and you are truly a prodigious poster of Jewish wreckage, just wrecking these Jews. It's crazy, but I've never seen anybody better at this. That's why you're a national treasure. Guys, Carl Rattle, give him some Romans if you would, please, and go check him out. Follow him on Twitter. Go find his Substack. Give him a follow over there, too. You won't be disappointed. He's always doing fantastic work. He's always kind enough to come grace us with some of his time every month. And I already can't wait until May. And I know that you've gone way over and above. And I want to say thanks again for all your time and energy and all the work that you do for our people. And I couldn't ask to have a better friend or better guest or to be working with a better person. So, you're one of my group of go-to people if I have a question or if I need help with something, and you're always there. And I want to say thank you for that. Truly, personally, I really appreciate you.
I know that. I mean, as you listen, probably don't know, but Flood gets really depressed at various different times in his life.
All
So there is a small there is a small Telegram group, almost of people going, Flood, stop being silly.
Yeah.
I'm
Chill
one
out,
of them,
Flood.
so
Yeah. Calm down, Flood.
calm down, calm
Actually,
down. It's not quite as bad as all that.
yeah. They don't know. Nobody knows until now about the secret group. But yes, we have a secret group. And honestly, I've pulled together people that I trust completely and people that I think really do what they do for the benefit of our people in our race. And so it's a small group now, but it's going to get bigger and bigger. And then we're going to take
Yeah.
over the world. Carl, thanks for joining, and I'll let you get on with your life, and look forward to next time, sir.
Okay, well, I always look forward to coming on. I always look forward to chatting with you and chatting with your listeners. And if anyone's got any questions, just at me on X. I will respond. If I don't respond, just at me until I do, because I don't always see it because X suppresses stuff all the time, even though it slated doesn't.
And don't be giving
So
him any shit. He'll fuck you up. Carl will fuck you up. He won't even have to work at it. Lacunae. Bam! Magic word right there. Thanks, Carl. I'm gonna cut you off.
Yeah,
Goodbye.
no problem. Goodbye.
He's the best. He's the best for a reason. That's Carl Rattle. And legend, right? Legendary. Look for him on Night Nation Review on Wednesday. And like you said, if you got any questions, you got some arguments you need settled, you need something debunked, check his Substack and then hit him up on Twitter. And he is very good about answering questions. And if you got some Jew on your ass, just drag him on by, tag Carl. He'll take care of it, man. I'm telling you, he's a little bit like that. He's the Terminator. He's the political Terminator. Political, totally political, nonviolent, peaceful, and legal Terminator. I've got about maybe 15 minutes before I should start wrapping this up. Let me take a quick look over to FTJ. Let's see what's going on over at FTJ Land tonight. And we'll see who's going. He was totally right about this symbol, right? Doesn't that look Masonic? But it's not. It is a Carpenter's Guild symbol. And get wrecked. Get wrecked, all you Jews out there. You're all novices compared to this guy. He's truly a legend. And quite a few instances of this, right? A lot of stuff. That looked like a Freemason. That's a Freemason. Shit, nigga, that's a Freemason. Shut up, Mr. White Tuber. Everybody knows it's not a Freemason. Not everything's a Freemason. Not everything is Kabbalah. Not everything is some Gnostic wizard. Just the Flood Show. Let's go. Wow.
Wow. Wow. Wow. Wow.